call. I'm actually calling from Houston, Texas. We have a regional conference here. There's over 250 people here, which is by far the biggest conference we've ever had in this part of the chapters from Texas, Mississippi, and Louisiana. And so it's just great to be here with all the CCLers. They're over having lunch right now, and so we snuck over to do the call. Also today, the June conference is open for registration. So after the call is done today, you can actually go to our website and register for the June conference. And I know a lot of us are talking about the idea of what it's going to be like to be on the Hill with a bill in play. I'm pretty excited about that. So I know I'm going to be there. I know that Dr. Catherine Hayhoe is going to be there. I hope you're going to be there also. One of the benefits of having a bill is it allows us to communicate more effectively about what we're doing, because rather than explaining a concept to people, we can talk about the benefits of the actual legislation. So what we want to do is really pivot as an organization and talk about how effective the Energy Innovation and Carbon and Dividend Act is going to be. That'll drive emissions way beyond anything we could have gotten with the Clean Power Plan or Paris. That it's going to be good for people, which we'll get into with our speaker more in just a moment. We'll get into the health benefits with Dr. Desjarnais in a minute, but also, it'll put money in the pockets of people who could use a little bit more money. It's revenue neutral, so it doesn't cost the government anything. It's good for jobs. It'll add jobs, not just in green sectors, but throughout the economy. And last but not least, it's bipartisan. And it's not like we have so many bipartisan issues. It's like, oh, another bipartisan issue. So what we want to do now is to start to get very disciplined about talking about the benefits of the bill. Because almost always, if you talk about benefits, you're going to be more effective at communicating than you are talking about features. Okay, so our guest today is Dr. Natasha Desjarnais. She's a research coordinator at the National Environmental Health Association. Her specialty areas include climate change and environmental exposures. Dr. Desjarnais received her PhD in public health from the University of Louisville in 2015. As a postdoc at the university, she was awarded a fellowship by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences to investigate cardiovascular risks of air pollution exposures. And from my side, one thing that I'm really excited about is last year, Dr. Desjarnais joined our governing board and has just been a fantastic addition to our board. So, Dr. Desjarnais, welcome. We have a lot of things that we want to get to today, but let's just start by telling us a little bit about the National Environmental Health Association.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for the invitation. Thank you for the kind introduction. I am excited once again to be here with my Citizens Climate family and honored and grateful for the opportunity. So, yes, thank you for acknowledging NEHA, the National Environmental Health Association. NEHA is a nationwide nonprofit 501c3 organization, and we are a membership association incorporated in 1937. So our members are the environmental health workforce. So they're the people that ensure that we have clean air to breathe and clean water to drink. So they include air and water quality professionals, sanitarians, food safety, vector control, healthy housing, and the list goes on and on. And so as our staff, we work to build capacity within this workforce to ensure health and safety of the environments in which we live. So we've had a lot of climate change activities going on over the years. NEHA is a member of the U.S. Climate and Health Alliance. We also participated in the Global Climate and Health Forum, which was part of the Global Climate Action Summit, where Citizens Climate also had affiliate events as well that I was excited to participate in. Also for NEHA, we are members of the Leadership Circle of Eco-America's Climate for Health program. And we're funded currently by by CDC, as well as Eco-America to do climate and health activities. So with CDC, we recently awarded some mini grants to a state and a community across the U.S. that are tackling climate and health adaptation. And then also with Eco-America, I would like everyone to stay tuned. We've got something coming on the horizon, We have a white paper report that's coming out on climate change and emergency preparedness and sharing the role of environmental health professionals. So for my role at NEHA, I'm leading our research activities internally, determining our research agenda, also understanding the needs of the environmental health workforce and priorities therein, and then also looking at emerging environmental health issues, climate change being one. And I want to acknowledge two of my coworkers were planning to dial in for the call. So I just wanted to give a shout to Natalie Brown and Ayanna Jones, who are also colleagues of mine at NEHA.
Great, great. Well, welcome both Natalie and Ayanna. Is that how you pronounce that?
Ayanna.
Ayanna. Okay, I was close, right? Okay, good. So we want to get into the different aspects that climate change affects health. And let's just start with the air. What are the things that exacerbates? What kind of problems does it cause? What kinds of things that will help if we get emissions under control?
Absolutely. So climate change is caused by the increase of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and this is causing heat and pollutants to be trapped below. And this is how climate change is decreasing the quality of the air that we breathe. So this poor air quality is linked with poor asthma outcomes as well as cardiovascular outcomes. Harvard Six City study that took place in the early 90s found that there were higher mortality rates in places that had higher pollution. And then in 2007, there was a study released that showed that they quantified this with life expectancy and found that in places that are dirtier or have worse air pollution, the life expectancy is shorter. So it's climate change is harming our health. It's threatening our lives, and it's also shortening our lives. But it also, in addition to air pollution, it's causing a longer, hotter, warm season. And this longer, hotter, warm season is causing a longer and more intense pollen season, which is really bad for folks with asthma or allergic asthma. I'm sorry, with allergies or allergic asthma. And so climate change is causing decreased workplace productivity in that regard and school absences. And then in addition, climate change is causing more frequent and more intense flooding. This leaves mold behind in our homes. And mold is also a negative air quality trigger, especially for those with asthma or allergies. And there are many people left vulnerable when it comes to air pollution. We're all at risk, and I want to be clear that we're all at risk, but there are some of us that are more vulnerable, our children in particular. The World Health Organization reports that 88% of the burden of climate change globally falls on children. That's a disservice to our children and the asthma, missed school days, and so much more come directly related to air pollution exposures, but also our elderly. And we're doing a disservice to them as well, that they've paved the way for us and we're not leaving them a great environment to enjoy their later life. The elderly are more likely to have pre-existing illnesses, and that leaves them a bit more susceptible to air pollution exposures. And then we've got to think about, when it comes to air quality, people that live on the fence lines. These are people that live in neighboring areas to pollution emitters. It could be highways. It also could be industrial polluters. And so they have a heavier burden of air pollution. They are more likely to be communities of color, and they're more likely to be impoverished communities. And these groups have higher health burdens because they have pre-existing, or they're more likely to have pre-existing illness, and there are many health disparities there that are further exacerbated by climate change. So there's a snapshot of climate change in air. I could probably go on for the entire length of the call, but certainly I'll be glad to take questions around air and climate change as they
come. Okay, good. Maybe we'll have a chance to get to that. So let's transition over to water then. You know, so there's increased flooding, increasing coastal issues, and what kind of health ramifications are there from that?
Absolutely. So with the instability, with this increased carbon dioxide and increased heat that's left on the ground level, we've got instability in our atmosphere, and this is increasing the frequency and intensity that we experience extreme weather events, also increasing precipitation on both ends, flooding and drought. So as it pertains to flooding, this increases injuries and illness and drowning, and those that are exposed to flooding. I myself could share an example of my family and I were in a flood situation. There was a flash flooding incident. The road completely flooded, and we found ourselves at a point where we couldn't see the street anymore. Unfortunately, we proceeded, which is not what you're supposed to do. If you don't see any street lines, turn around, don't drown. And we did not. Luckily, we made it through. And of course, that's one instance. So you can't say one instance is climate change, but this is happening so frequently, and especially in floodplains. So there are cases, as I said, with injury and drowning. But also, when we have flooding events, this can send our, it can overhaul our sewer system and send untreated sewage directly into our water supply. And this can increase our risk of having gastrointestinal illness. There's one study that looked at gastrointestinal illness outbreaks across the U.S. and found that over half of them were preceded by an extreme rainfall event. So this definitely increases our risk of gastrointestinal illness. And then also with sea level rise, the risks are similar: injury, illness, death, and water contamination. This water contamination not only hurts our drinking water supply, but it also can contaminate our crops and foods that we'll eat. And then there's a heavy mental health toll that comes with surviving extreme rainfall events like this, and even being displaced as well. So it not only affects us physically, but climate change also has a heavy mental wellness aspect as well.
Cool. I want to get into some of the other climate-related items, but one thing I want to make sure we get to is one of the things everybody in this call wants to do is be able to communicate effectively about the connection and reach people. So are there tips for, you know, do this, don't do that, so that we, you know, when we're talking about the relationship between climate
I think Mark may have frozen.
I'm sorry, my internet went weak for a little bit. I was just asking Dr. Desjardins about communicating about the connection between climate change and health. And are there tips for things that we should focus on and things that we should stay away from if we want to be able to powerfully make the connection with people?
So I think bringing health into the climate conversation is one of the most important things that we can do. Health is something that's important to many people, and many people can identify with many stories surrounding climate change and health. Like I shared about my family and the driving and flooding experiences. Many of us have had health-related experiences when we kind of dig deep. But also beyond that, the health, many of the health organizations, especially their leadership, all stand by and say that climate change is the greatest threat to public health that we are currently facing. And framing it in that regard is especially helpful in conveying the urgency of acting on climate change and health. So definitely conveying that acting on climate change protects and advances health is of great importance. In addition, I think it's also quite important as we communicate about climate change to speak to justice and to speak to vulnerabilities. And I've been told that with the new Congress, that speaking to justice is something that appeals to this new Congress. So speaking to those that are on the fence line, speaking to those children especially, and those children have been a constant in climate and health communications in the last several years. So continuing that going, speaking to the elderly, speaking also to tribal populations, those that have cultural ties to the land and that climate change is taking away some of those ties. I'm also speaking to vulnerable groups like disabled persons that are further harmed by climate change or extreme weather events, for example. So really speaking to vulnerabilities, especially with the mindset that those who have contributed least to the climate crisis bear the highest burden of the climate crisis. Also, I think it's important to bring mental wellness into the conversation, but with that, because it's largely not a part of the conversation, but when you think of Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Harvey and others, people have done research on the mental health impacts of those, and it's worth including in the conversation for certain. But with that, it's important not to stigmatize. And that has been a challenge with mental health conversations over the years and why they're not largely part of mainstream climate and health conversations. And then also with stigmatization, when we speak of other vulnerable populations like impoverished communities, for me, myself, I speak to it as a community. I'm in population health, so I speak to everything pretty much in terms of being a community, but not saying poor people or impoverished people, but an impoverished community, because there may be many people within the communities that they themselves are not impoverished, but they live in an impoverished community. And it's really, the issue is that their communities lack resources or their communities lack the infrastructure to be resilient under a changing climate. And then that brings me to resilience. We need to speak resilience as we talk about climate change. So putting the focus on the positive, because I can get very negative as I list out all the different ways climate change harms our health, which I think are very important, but that can limit conversations. And so we can frame things in terms of how taking action on climate change builds more resilient communities and stronger communities, also tapping into the resilience that we already have as a means for solutions on climate change to protect health.
Okay, let me jump to one of the questions that came in the chat so far, which is, can you attribute a number of deaths per year to the burning of greenhouse gases? Is there a, can that be quantified?
Well, let's see. I don't want to say that it's not out there, but I am aware of some air pollution statistics that are linked with death. And last year, I've heard at multiple health meetings, and I don't recall the source, so I apologize for this, but last year it was reported that 7 million people are dying each year due to air pollution exposures. This may go beyond greenhouse gases, mm-hmm. but that's an important figure that we've been sharing as we talk about air pollution and climate and health.
Cool. Okay. And then we didn't touch on vector-borne diseases. So I know, you know, we're hearing like there's more, you know, ticks and, you know, all the things associated with that. But can you say just more about the vector area?
Yes, I can. So as I said, climate change is causing a longer, hotter, warm season. And this is increasing the geographic range of vectors. And so these vectors are insects and ticks and rodents. And they are carrying diseases that are a threat to our health. So this longer, hotter, warm season is expanding the area in which they can reside. Maine is my example, and I'm going to come back to Maine, but it's certainly not limited to Maine. These insects, ticks, and other vectors are carrying diseases like Zika virus, West Nile virus, and Lyme disease. And so with Lyme disease, and Maine is my example, as the temperature has gotten warmer and more habitable to ticks, where it once wasn't as habitable to these vectors, about 20 years ago, Maine reported around a dozen cases of Lyme disease. This past summer, in 2018, they reported 1,800 cases of Lyme disease. So we're definitely experiencing the health effects and need action so that this warming does not continue and these environments no longer are hospitable where they weren't hospitable to these vectors.
Ricky, what do we have in the chat?
There's a connection between mental health and climate change.
Can you add a little bit more about mental health and climate change? It looks like there's the questions are popping up about that. So anything else you can add there?
Sure. And thanks for the questions. One area of which climate change impacts mental health is extreme heat. Once again, we've got these longer, hotter, warm season, and we're having more frequent and more intense bouts of extreme heat events. And when we have these, we actually have temperatures of which some psychotropic drugs or drugs used to treat mental illness become inactive. So that's one threat that climate change poses on mental wellness. In addition, climate change causes extreme weather events, and that can harm our mental health when we survive those extreme weather events. It can increase our anxiety, it can increase stress, and it can also increase our risk of post-traumatic stress disorder. So it says, as I said, there's a whole lot of studies that are out there on Hurricane Katrina, and I'd be interested to see some of the results that are coming out of the more recent storms, Hurricane Maria, Hurricane Harvey, Irma, Michael, because those also clearly leave mental devastation behind as well. But in terms of Hurricane Katrina, one study found that nearly half, 49% of Hurricane Katrina survivors were left with some type of anxiety or mood disorder following the storm. And then there's another study that demonstrated that 1 in 6 Hurricane Katrina survivors developed post-traumatic stress disorder after the storm. And so with extreme weather, there's certainly the destruction, there is the devastation of the event, and then there's also the displacement, and all those have a heavy toll on our mental health. Drought also is linked with mental health conditions. And this connection is largely through those that have close ties to the land close cultural ties to land, or close economic ties to the land, like the agricultural community. And close cultural ties, by that I mean our Native American communities or tribal communities. So there was a study looking at a Midwest drought in the mid-1980s. And they were looking at farmers and found that suicide during that time actually doubled within the farmers in the Midwest. And they were able to associate that with the drought and the economic impact that it has. So climate change elicits a lot of mental health impacts. And I'm appreciative of the question and the opportunity to connect climate change, not only to the physical health, but also to our mental health.
So we have a very strong health action team. It's very active. They do a lot. But one of the other chapters you're asking is, what should the other local chapters reach out to more healthcare professionals? What's the best way to go about doing that? It's certainly, you know, it's one of the important things in our issue is always trusted messenger, right?
Yes.
Somebody who seems like they're not stuck in one tribe or the other. And it would seem like healthcare professionals would be good in that area. So do you have some recommendations about how we would do outreach in that area?
So you've hit the nail on the head. The health professionals are trusted professionals, and particularly nurses are the most trusted health professionals. Also, health professionals carry a lot of evidence with them because many of them are able to see the impacts of climate change in their practice. So they can share firsthand stories of unfortunate situations of air quality and asthma, for example, or air quality and allergies that they can actually share, or waterborne exposures that they can actually share. And they are voices that people listen to, that they listen to on the Hill, that they take to be serious and incredible sources of information. So I definitely encourage reaching out to health professionals. There are organizations of health professionals that also may be worth looking into as well to bring their voice into the conversation. But as a health professional myself, I wholeheartedly endorse bringing their voices to tell their unique perspectives as it pertains to climate change and health outcomes.
Wow, so boy, you touched a nerve with the mental health side. The chat went kind of crazy there for a while. So thank you for all that. And some people put in some good resources and additional places people could find information. So that was great. So thank you again. For those of you who haven't been around for a while, Dr. Dijonette has spoken at our national conference. She's been a guest before on this call. She's just one of our really important resources, and we're extremely grateful to have you. Thank you for making yourself available again on a Saturday.
Thank you so much. It's just an honor.
All right, great. Happy Saturday. Talk to you soon.
Happy Saturday.
Thanks. Okay, thanks. All right. Well, as I said earlier, I am in Houston, Texas with 251 CCLers working on regional issues and getting to work with each other and meeting some people we haven't met before. One of the things that you'll hear on next month's call, most of you are familiar with our Climate Guardians, who each donated $10,000 to create $1 million matching pool at the end of last year. We ended up raising $1.2 million to meet that match. Those Climate Guardians are now creating a match for monthly donors. So next month you'll hear about a matching program where anybody who contributes on a monthly basis, their donation will also be matched. So I want to give you a heads up on that, next month's call, you'll hear about that a little bit also. Also, I'm going to go over the actions for this month in a few minutes, but one thing we would like everybody to do is we would like every single person to call their member of the House of Representatives and ask them to co-sponsor the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act. We want to get as many people on that as quickly as possible. Some people are a little bit anxious that the ratio is so much more Democrat than Republicans. We know there'll be additional Republicans coming on, but it's also very, very important to get a lot of Democrats on. The Green New Deal is drawing a lot of attention to climate change, and that's a really good thing. That's good for us that it's drawing so much attention to climate change. But some people who are Green New Dealers are also anti-carbon pricing. So we need to get a kind of firewall set up quickly where there's enough Democrats to make sure and establish that this is a good idea from both sides of the aisle. So in addition to the actions that we have listed for you to take, one of the things we're asking you to do is for everybody to call your member of Congress and ask that, and that's just the House until we get a companion bill in the Senate, and ask your member of the House to sponsor the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act. Another thing that's kind of exciting that's happening right now is we're starting to get endorsements in on the actual bill. So Tompkins County, New York was the first one where we had just a general endorsement of carbon fee and dividend, but then switched it from that to the bill. So congratulations, New York 23rd, Miranda, and anybody who was involved in that. That's fantastic. And then we got two huge ones in the winter sports area yesterday. The National Ski Area Association and Protect Our Winters both endorsed the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act. So that is very, very exciting. Okay. In Canada, what we're going to be doing is asking everybody to join Canada's social media platform. Also asking people to, local city council levers to join the Canadian climate leadership, and then start planning for Earth Day. And as usual in Canada, Ontario has its own separate actions, and so Ontario, we know you always have bonus actions. Okay, in the US, we are asking you to make a chapter plan. We've had you do that previously in some Januaries, but this is the first time with a bill actually in play. So we're asking you to look at our five levers of political will and see what would be the best areas of focus for your chapter. What would be the best thing where your chapter can create the greatest amount of leverage it should? We're not gonna change what we're doing, we're just gonna do it better this year. And so we're gonna take those five levers, media, both social and regular, lobbying, grassroots, grass tops, building your chapter, and looking to see where your chapter can really focus effectively in supporting the bill this year. There's a fantastic communication exercise, and I hope you do the communication exercise, because what it does is focus on listening. And we have been working on trying to be better listeners for 10 years, and we've still got a long ways to go. So I think anytime we have a chance to practice that, that's a good thing. Now, sometimes people are concerned that they hear about everything but us out there. So I want to just show you a short clip of one of the presidential candidates talking about, you'll hear. So here's a presidential candidate in Iowa. Hold on a second. We just had the sound off.
Is obviously a huge issue. I think it's a threat to American prosperity, and I think it's a huge threat to our national security, actually. So we have to deal with it. We have to start dealing with it soon. If we don't deal with it, we are in many ways leaving a debt to the next generation, because they're going to have to do some dramatic things to deal with it that will cost a lot of money, right? That'll take a huge amount out of their economy. So our basically kind of kicking this issue, kicking the can on climate change down the road, is basically leaving a future generation a debt they can't repay. What I would do is put a carbon tax in place. I introduced the only bipartisan carbon tax bill in the Congress last year. You know, this gets back to my approach to my candidacy, which is I want to do big things, but I actually want to get them done. I want to find common ground and I want to make progress. I don't want to keep talking about climate change. I don't want to keep moving the goalposts on climate change. I actually want to get something done right away. And I think a carbon tax is something we can do right away, but it has to be structured right. It's got to be structured in a way where all the revenues that we raise from the carbon tax are given right back to the American people in the form of a dividend. And that's the bipartisan proposal that I was able to get introduced in the Congress that I can make law as president.
For people who feel strongly about this, there's calls for presidential candidates to support the Green New Deal. Is that something you're interested in, would be willing to support?
Well, one of the problems we have with politics right now is people get asked to support things that are not defined. Right? So the Green New Deal, as best I can tell, is an undefined term. As someone who was given the Legislator of the Year award by the Citizens Climate Lobby, I'm actually incredibly passionate about climate and have done a huge amount on the issue and have very specific plans. So if a Green New Deal means putting a price on carbon, increasing the Department of Energy research budget by fivefold, because we ultimately have to innovate ourselves out of this problem, and doing things to support investments in renewables, if that's the Green New Deal, then I'm all for it. But I actually already have those proposals introduced, and a bunch of them are bipartisan. So some of the problems with the Green New Deal is no one's defined it yet.
Okay, so that's former Representative Delaney of Maryland, who's retired from Congress so he could run for president, so that's kind of exciting. I did an exercise last week with the group leaders where I asked them to imagine what it will be like being on Capitol Hill with a bill in place. And Kathy Orlinsky from Los Angeles said, you know, on Tuesday night when we have people come up and share at the end of the conference at the reception and people talk about how their member joined the caucus, she says, this year I'm hoping to be there and have people walk up and say, my member just signed onto the bill. And then John Clark talked about being in meetings lots of times with members of Congress where the member gets called out because they're a vote. And he goes, I hope we're there this year and my member gets called out because he's voting on our bill. So conference is open. You can register for the conference today. There are 1,200 lobbying spots, so not an unlimited number of lobbying spots, 1,200. So if you're planning on coming, do get yourself registered so you can make sure and get yourself a lobbying spot. Ricky's going to unmute everybody, and if you want to yell goodbye and give Dr. Desjarnais a thank you, that'd be fantastic.
I can see you.
Again, start by reflecting back and distilling. So you don't think punishing us or God's in control of this. Do you think that that's with personal conversations.
Okay, we don't care about anybody else.
Hello. Why is not? She is the speaker.
Why from Hamilton, Ontario?
I just took